I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Dabalina Chakraborty.
And I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And since we're in the middle of Atlantic hurricane season in our part of the world, and maybe it's also a little bit because it's been really stormy here all week, so we've got storms on the brain, we thought it'd be interesting to take a look at some historical storms. After all, the truly big ones really are kind of characters in their own right, and they often change the story of whatever area they decide to visit and the lives of the people who live there.
I think that's really emphasized by the fact that we give them names now. So they really do have sort of a personality, and those names become almost taboo in the immediate years after a really big storm hits.
They do.
And I think that's especially true with Hurricane Katrina. So a recent storm in recent history, you know, we're not going to be talking about Katrina on the podcast today, but it certainly comes to mind if you're thinking about really giant storms in the United States.
Right. It was a Category 5 storm, led to severe flooding and spawned tornadoes that killed around 1,800 people across several states. But as Sarah said, we're not going to get into Katrina in this podcast so much today, but it did get us thinking a lot about some of the most destructive storms that left their marks on the world over time. So we're going to take a look at just a handful of those. We're not going to cover them all by any means today, but we're going to take a look at a few that we think are pretty interesting.
We are. So we're going to start back in 1925 with a tornado. And most of the storms we're going to be talking about are hurricanes or cyclones, cyclones in the non-American sense of Dorothy and Oz. But this one is a true tornado, the tri-state tornado. And your average tornado is about 500 to 2,000 feet wide, and it travels at about a speed of 30 miles per hour. So pretty scary, even if you just leave it at that. We had a tornado in Atlanta a few years ago, went right through downtown. It was a scary storm.
It was, but this next entry on our list, the 1925 Tri-State Tornado, was massive enough to leave that tornado and most typical tornadoes that we encounter in this country in the dust. It formed at about 1 p.m. on March 18th, 1925, somewhere around the town of Ellington in southeastern Missouri, and it was nearly a mile wide, moving at an average speed of about 62 miles per hour, and at times even up to 73 miles per hour. And it was possibly because of that great width that a lot of people who saw the storm coming didn't even realize at first that it was a tornado.
It just looked like a cloud wall.
Right. And according to an article by Sean Potter in WeatherWise magazine, W.F. Haywood, who was the postmaster for Ellington, made one of the first recorded sightings of the tornado. And he just observed it as a, quote, blue-black cloud mass that was coming toward them. He was lucky, though, compared to some who didn't even see it coming at all.
Yeah, people described being in buildings when windows suddenly started to shatter, walls came crumbling down, whole houses were just lifted off the ground.
Yeah, Wizard of Oz style.
Definitely, and too late if you realize you're in a tornado. But it moved quickly, too. So even though it was so giant, it was moving along at quite a clip. It covered a lot of ground. It hit parts of Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana, traveling a total of 219 miles in only 3.5 hours, which was more than 36 times as much as an average tornado covers, more than 36 times as much ground.
In an article in American Heritage, Wallace Aiken calls it, quote, the longest uninterrupted track on a record. In total, 695 people were killed and more than 2,000 were injured as a result of the storm. 15,000 homes were destroyed. The town that was hardest hit, which is the one we want to kind of give a few details about, was Murfreesboro, Illinois. 234 people died in that town alone, and that set a record for the most tornado fatalities in a single place. And Aiken, the writer that we just mentioned, he was actually a toddler living in Murfreesboro when the tornado struck. And his article that we mentioned relates some stories of residents and others who lived through the experience. I think he also has a book on the subject. And one story that he relates that I found particularly chilling involves the town's children who were in school at the time that the tornado struck. The school building basically collapsed on the kids. 25 died. Some who survived struggled out from under the debris on their own and headed for their homes. You know, it's a natural instinct for a kid. You know, I'm going to head for home. I'm going to find my family. But they found in many cases that their homes were completely gone. Even entire neighborhoods had vanished.
That's so scary. One friend of Aiken's recalled reaching his home, what should have been his home, which was nothing but an open field with her grandmother in the middle of it, decapitated and still sitting in her rocking chair. So completely horrifying sight after surviving an already horrifying situation.
Yeah, and horrific sights like these seem pretty typical for those who managed to live through that initial chaos, since there were plenty of dead and injured people around who needed tending to. Medical teams and supplies started to pour in from all over the country. One point that I thought was interesting, according to Potter's article, Chicago even offered up some liquor that had been confiscated by the federal government after some prohibition raids. And so they, quote, made this available in a medicinal way to the storm sufferers.
That's so bizarre.
There is a silver lining to this disaster, in a way. It raised public awareness about tornadoes. I was really interested to find in this Popular Mechanics article, John Galvin writes about how even using the word tornado was considered taboo by the National Weather Service at this time. Basically, because tornadoes were so unpredictable, talking about them was thought to cause pointless panic.
So don't let people know until their houses are rattling.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if they exactly looked at it that way, but I guess they just thought there was really no use since they couldn't really forecast them. Right. But after the tri-state tornado, local tornado spotting networks started popping up. So people were more aware and were taking steps to protect themselves a little bit. And of course, researchers know so much more about tornadoes now than they did back then, so much so that in recent years, some have suggested that the tri-state tornado might have actually been a family of tornadoes, not one single tornado, that was caused by a supercell thunderstorm.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At one of the most famous restaurants in the world, there's a table in the corner where the most incredible conversations on the planet are happening every week with owner Ruthie Rogers and amazing guests like Martha Stewart.
But I did have an affair with one of his best friends.
Jimmy Fallon.
Do you want a zip line over your dad while he gets attacked by alligators?
And Paul McCartney.
John and I hitchhiked to Paris.
We've saved you a seat. Ruthie's Table 4. Listen to Ruthie's Table 4 on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So this theory hasn't been definitively proven, and I guess may never be, but this remains the single deadliest tornado in history because they can't prove that it was a family of tornadoes.
Well, so now that we've discussed that type of storm pretty thoroughly, we're going to move on to hurricanes, and we're going to be talking about a few hurricanes in this episode. And the first one is the Great Hurricane of 1780. And today we're lucky that meteorologists have the knowledge and the technology to estimate the strength of storms and even predict their potential paths to some degree. So, you know, you were just talking about you couldn't tell where tornadoes were going. Imagine if you couldn't tell really where a hurricane was going to go. I know it's still a little up in the air, but they can give you some warning. But when you're talking about a storm like the next one on our list, though, which happened more than 200 years ago, of course, there was not that luxury. So modern researchers have had to piece together some details regarding characteristics of the Great Hurricane of 1780 based on anecdotal evidence of the kind of destruction that it caused, sort of having to look back at it and figure out what the storm was really like.
Yeah, and that destruction that you just mentioned was really significant, to say the least. The fact that, just considering the fact that it stood out so much in what was already an active hurricane season that year should hint at that, but the death toll poll also speaks for itself. More than 20,000 people in the Eastern Caribbean lost their lives. According to the Caribbean Disaster Emergency Response Agency, researchers estimate that the hurricane formed in the Atlantic and moved westward very slowly at about 6 nautical miles per hour. The storm got to Barbados on October 10th, where, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, it destroyed nearly all the homes on the island and about 4,500 people lost their lives. The hurricane went on to hit pretty much every island, from Tobago to the Leeward Islands to Hispaniola, but the biggest death tolls came out of Barbados and Martinique, where 9,000 people died, and also St. Eustatius, where 4,500 people also died.
Researchers also believe that the Great Hurricane was a Category 5, with winds greater than 200 miles per hour. And again, they've guessed that, pieced it together just from reports of the storm damage and examples of anecdotes that were offered up by the Caribbean Disaster Emergency Response Agency. One of those examples came from a letter sent in December of that year from Sir George Rodney, and he wrote about the events in Barbados and said, quote, "The strongest buildings in the whole of the houses, most of which were stone and remarkable for their solidity, gave way to the fury of the wind and were torn up to their foundations. All the forts destroyed and many of the heavy cannon carried upwards of 100 feet from the forts. Had I not been an eyewitness, nothing could have induced me to have believed it. More than 6,000 persons perished and all the inhabitants were entirely ruined." So pretty serious. I mean, the sight of cannons blowing up into the air, I think that's the strongest point he makes there.
That's true. But I think this other point made by Dr. Gilbert Blaine in a letter that he wrote is also very interesting. He says, quote, "What will give as strong an idea of the force of the wind as anything, many of them," and the trees is what he was referring to, "were stripped of their bark." So today we know that this hasn't been observed in hurricanes where winds are about 200 miles per hour. And that's why researchers guessed that the winds had to be greater than that. So,
and I think that's so neat that they can compare the history of other trees and other wind speeds and figure out this one from 1780.
Yeah. And the casualties here weren't all on land either. Also of historical note here is that the American Revolution was going on at the time that this hurricane struck, which meant that plenty of European naval forces, both British and French, were concentrated in the Caribbean. So thousands of soldiers died as their vessels were damaged, destroyed, swept away. Encyclopedia Britannica says something like more than 40 French ships sank near Martinique alone.
And this is something I have never heard mentioned when you learn about the American Revolution. It seems like it had to have shaken people up a little bit, at least. But okay, so the next storm we're going to talk about is certainly, we're jumping ahead quite a bit. It's a more modern storm, and it's one that I'm guessing a lot of you, especially if you're in the United States, have probably heard about before. It has the distinction of being known as the greatest natural disaster in U.S. history.
Yeah, it took place in Galveston, Texas in 1900 and is sometimes known simply as the Galveston Storm. Galveston at the time was one of the wealthiest cities in America, and it was the largest city in Texas and a big trade center.
A boom town, really.
Yeah. Located on a barrier island in the Gulf of Mexico, Galveston had gotten the message before that it should do some storm preparation, including maybe constructing a seawall. And they'd seen nearby towns destroyed by hurricanes in previous years, but they still didn't make any moves to fortify the city prior to 1900. The city got its first inkling that a storm was headed its way in early September of that year, and what started out as an area of, quote, unsettled weather near the Windward Islands became a tropical storm that moved over Cuba and hit Louisiana and Mississippi on the way to Texas.
So by the time it reached Galveston, though, on September 8th, 1900, it was about a Category 4 hurricane by modern estimates. Again, meteorologists are having to do some backtracking here. When it first reached Galveston in the morning, it caused some flooding, but it was still sunny out, and according to an article by Chuck Lyons in History Magazine, most locals weren't too concerned about the storm. They'd seen big storms before living on the Gulf. They thought they could, quote, ride it out, as sometimes people do in big storms like this. But as the day went on, the wind started to pick up, and it ultimately reached estimated speeds of about 120 to 135 miles per hour. The highest speed recorded was actually 100 miles per hour, but there's a note there. The wind instrument was destroyed shortly after taking that measurement, so we can assume it went quite a bit higher than that.
The flooding also got much worse. The rain just kept coming, and the tidal surges reached from 8 to 15 feet. People started heading upwards, trying to get to the highest points that they could in their homes, but it didn't really help. The surges swept up homes from the foundation, and the wind was just throwing trees and other objects around, so it was just utter chaos.
And we should note, too, that as a barrier island, Galveston, of course, was very low to the sea.
That's true.
There was no high ground to really get to. According to another article by Potter in WeatherWise magazine, the entire southeast and west areas of the city were just wiped out. Pretty much all the houses were just swept away. Most other buildings were destroyed too. There were debris everywhere. There were bodies alive and dead trapped under the buildings. Potter quotes Isaac Klein, who was in charge of the Galveston Weather Bureau office at the time, as saying the site the next day was, quote, one of the most horrible sights that ever a civilized people looked upon.
Anywhere between 6,000 and 12,000 people died as a result of this hurricane. Estimates usually sort of waver around, I guess, 6,000. But
as many of these storms, as they do for many of these storms, we have huge spans of numbers here.
Yeah, and the exact number of people who died may never be known. People were drowned, of course, crushed by debris, and nearly 90 kids in a local orphanage were killed. Just an example of some of the people who died in this storm. About 30,000 were left homeless, too. Relief came in from other areas of the country, but there were so many dead, bodies had to be burned for weeks after the storm because there was just no way to bury them all efficiently. Galveston never quite recaptured the prominence that it once had, according to Lyon's article, but it did survive and managed to rebuild. One of the results of what happened, in 1902, the city started building a 17-foot seawall to protect itself, and houses and buildings were kind of raised up to that level, too. So there's more awareness, again, to keep this from happening.
Yeah, Galveston really ended up having to almost raise the entire city so they'd be a little safer.
They did.
So we're going to be moving on now to another hurricane. But before we do that, we need to discuss the relative merits of coastal living and inland living. And I'd say one of the obvious perks of living by the coast is that you're near the beach. But one of the upsides of living far inland is that you're usually spared the full brunt of a hurricane, plus really terrifying side effects like tsunamis if you're in cyclone territory, or storm surges.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At one of the most famous restaurants in the world, there's a table in the corner where the most incredible conversations on the planet are happening every week with owner Ruthie Rogers and amazing guests like Martha Stewart.
But I did have an affair with one of his best friends.
Jimmy Fallon.
Do you want a zip line over your dad while he gets attacked by alligators?
And Paul McCartney.
John and I hitchhiked to Paris.
We've saved you a seat. Ruthie's Table 4. Listen to Ruthie's Table 4 on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're not completely off the hook, though, unfortunately. In 1928, an extremely rare natural disaster occurred. It was a freshwater storm surge at Lake Okeechobee in south central Florida, which is just north of the what we think of the Everglades today, and 40 miles northwest of Palm Beach. And that surge, plus the effects of the hurricane itself, killed up to 3,000 people, meaning that it came pretty close to Galveston, depending on which numbers you're using for Galveston, as the deadliest storm in U.S. history.
In the early 20th century, South Florida underwent a huge development boom. Just to give you some background on this area, areas like Palm Beach, which is an Atlantic barrier island, attracted the wealthy, while many of the inland Everglade areas, including the area around Lake Okeechobee, were drained for agriculture. And according to NOAA, only about 50,000 people were living in South Florida at the time. So migrant laborers from mostly the Bahamas arrived to do the farm work and set up small towns around the lake.
So those are our two focus areas, really different worlds economically, but both clearly very vulnerable to weather. One, a barrier island, always vulnerable. The other, small towns with shoddy structures sitting plumb next to one of the largest freshwater lakes in the country that only happened to be about 12 to 15 feet above sea level. So again, according to NOAA, the storm we're discussing first hit land about September 12, 1928. 300 people were killed when it swept over Puerto Rico. From there, it moved through the Bahamas and hit the mainland on September 16th, right in Palm Beach County. And the coast was really badly damaged by the wind, the storm, but warnings had allowed many people to evacuate or to take cover. Inland, though, water from the storm caused Lake Okeechobee to start to pool. You know, we mentioned that it's a very large lake. It's also a very shallow lake. And finally, it broke through this short, inadequate muck levee that was meant to protect the settlements to itself. And the freshwater storm surge then, at that point, rose about 12 feet around the lake, drowning people in the low-lying area and flooding towns like Belleglade, South Bay, and Canal Point, as well as other towns. And we mentioned a minute ago that the death toll could have been as high as 3,000, but there have been so many recalculations regarding this storm over the years. And I mentioned earlier that there's a lot of discrepancy in many of these numbers, and we'll discuss some of the reasons for that more later. But For this storm, it seems like there were some racial politics involved. Different sources from immediately after the flood ranged from 1,000 dead from the Miami Herald to 2,300 dead in the Miami Daily News.
So let's talk about that for a second. Why was there so much confusion and miscalculation? According to the American Meteorological Society and Russell Post, an estimated 3/4 of the dead were field workers, mostly non-white migratory workers. Many of them were only known to even friends by their nicknames. Many of the bodies were lost. Post article includes a quote describing how the surge carried people into the, quote, sawgrass wastes. And the search for bodies ended November 1st because of lack of funds. So they
a mixture of not being able to actually locate the bodies and just not knowing who was there alive in the first place.
Right. Many of the black dead and some of the white dead also were buried in segregated mass graves. Simultaneous segregated memorial services were held Sunday, September 30th, 1928, in West Palm Beach. Mary McLeod Bethune attended one of the black services.
She was a big civil rights activist and educator at the time. Economically, though, the storm was also really damaging. It caused an estimated $25 million in damages, which is now equal to about $16 billion if you adjust for wealth, population, and inflation, according to Post. It also ended the boom of the 1920s South Florida development, because only 2 years earlier there had been a similarly large storm that had destroyed a lot of Miami, so people buying their luxury houses were starting to realize this was a risky area to live in, and that's why this one reminds me so much of the Galveston storm, because it really affected the whole trajectory of the city and the area.
Right. Another note here of the literary variety, Okeechobee, if it rang a bell for you, it might be from reading Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. Not to give anything away, but it's a major plot device between the heroine and the character Tea Cake. Floridian Hurston hadn't been in the state during the storm, but according to Valerie Boyd, she combined her interviews with survivors plus her own experience in a storm in the Bahamas in 1929 to create a realistic scene there.
And I have to say, it's probably been about 10 or so years since I read that book, but
yeah,
I can remember the storm scene. So our final storm for this list is the Bola Cyclone of 1970. And many of the storms we've discussed so far have been truly extraordinary storms, truly large storms. The Bola Cyclone, though, could have been just an average or maybe even under the right circumstances, a mild storm had it not hit where it did and had it not hit when it did. As it worked out, though, the storm, which is also called the Ganges-Brahmaputra Delta Cyclone, became one of the deadliest, if not the deadliest, tropical cyclone on record. It's also one of the world's worst natural disasters.
The storm formed over the Bay of Bengal November 8, 1970, and this was after the traditional season's end, so most people weren't even expecting more storms and were already kind of at max flood capacity for the year. It was also headed for the Ganges Delta, which was then a part of East Pakistan and one of the flattest, most flood-prone regions of the world. Flooding is expected. It's what delivers the rich sediment that makes the soil so fertile, but it also makes the land unstable since many rivers crisscross the region.
Yeah, for instance, many structures are built on these small sediment-made islands that only last a few years. You know, the sediment washes away, new islands form. So understandably, building temporary structures like this, you don't build really solid ones, really sturdy buildings and houses. But because the soil in this region is so rich from all that sediment, the Delta is also one of the most densely populated areas of the world, really comparable to the Netherlands, which is, I think, Europe's most populated country, or densely populated, rather. According to Benjamin Riley in Disaster and Human History, Case Studies in Nature, Society, and Catastrophe, in the decade before the flood, the population in this delta region had increased by about 30%, meaning that farmers were already having to push further into the mangrove forest buffer by the coast in order to eke out a living. And it also meant that the population was really young. There were a lot of very young children at the time.
So already there's this out-of-season storm, and it was the sixth of the season, and it's in a flood-prone area with a dense population living in mostly temporary housing. So just to set the scene right there, the storm made landfall as a Category 3 cyclone with a peak speed of 115 miles per hour. It hit right at high tide on a full moon night when people were sleeping. Many of the migrant workers who had arrived for rice harvest were sleeping outside. The storm surge created by the cyclone reached about 19 feet, wiping out everything that it hit. Since there wasn't high ground, people climbed trees only to find themselves surrounded by snakes.
And there's a really odd story. I mean, I'd say take it with a grain of salt, but it's mentioned by Riley. He discusses a Mrs. Kareem who credited a constrictor with saving her life. So most people, I'm sure if you found yourself suddenly in the tree with lots of snakes, that would be it. But she remembers losing consciousness, but at that moment being wrapped up by a constrictor who was really just trying to cling to anything on the tree, and it ended up saving her life and the life of her newborn child. So kind of a wild storm story there, but I guess you never know what can happen in incidents like these. The death toll, though, was initially estimated to be at about 225,000, but it could have been as high as 500,000. And again, just like we discussed with the Okeechobee hurricane, there are a lot of reasons for why there's so much discrepancy here. And again, one is that there were probably a lot of migrant workers among the dead, and nobody knew who was there, nobody knew who they were. Plus undocumented residents, you know, just people who hadn't registered in any sort of way. And we mentioned this earlier, lots of young children, so maybe they weren't even on the books yet.
After the storm, hundreds of thousands of people were left without food. And since it had almost been harvest time, there were no stores of anything either. Agricultural equipment had been washed away. Salt water had inundated farmland. Livestock had drowned. The fishing industry was destroyed. And drinking water was contaminated, and people contracted cholera from that.
Many people were injured, too, after such a traumatic survival situation. They had broken bones. They had abrasions on their arms and their chests and thighs, something that relief workers Alfred Summer and W. Henry Moseley called, quote, cyclone syndrome, or, quote, the grim evidence of the tenacity with which the survivors had clung to the trees to withstand the buffeting of the waves. So just tearing yourself up trying to save your life during the storm surge. Then, despite all of these problems, you know, despite the starvation and the injuries, the government wasn't able to respond for 10 days, which was something that ultimately heightened tensions between East Pakistan and West Pakistan. And much of the relief ultimately ended up coming from India and the United States and later Great Britain and China, which sent rice supplies for the people. So when an already scheduled December election rolled around, a lot of new opposition politicians ended up being elected. And ultimately, after a civil war, East Pakistan became the independent country of Bangladesh. And one of its earliest goals, understandably, after all of this, was to set up better storm surge alerts so that people could be more prepared for something like this happening again.
Just a side note here, Hassan Mashriqui, a professor at LSU, got a map of Bangladesh from his father-in-law. He scanned the map for part of his work predicting storm surges in the Gulf of Mexico since he wanted to work on developing similar models for Bangladesh. He ended up creating an early warning system, which was tested in 2007 when Mashriqui noted a huge cyclone forming in the Bay of Bengal.
The way he went about spreading those warnings, though, it sounds so roundabout, it's amazing that it actually worked. But he began communicating, once he noticed this huge storm forming, began communicating with the U.S. Navy to find out how much the government in the area knew about what was going on, what kind of warnings were already in place. And when he realized from family that the storm wasn't really being treated very seriously, he got in touch with a food and disaster official in Bangladesh via his LSU freshman son and began sharing information, began tracking the storm. And many people were successfully evacuated from the areas identified as most at risk. And he also helped retroactively target rescue efforts. Here's where the storm went. Here's where you need to go. More than 3,000 people still died, which sounds like a huge number, but it was far fewer than a lot of the earlier cyclones, including, of course, the Bola cyclone that we already talked about.
So I guess that's promising that in most of these stories, we've seen some sort of progress
technology
at the end.
Upgrade, whether it is building a wall, you know, acknowledging the fact that your city is in pretty serious danger, or having some sort of software, having an early warning system in place can save lots of lives.
Yeah, and just that awareness that people have. I mean, it's sad, taking it seriously, not thinking that you're going to ride it out. I mean, I lived on the Gulf Coast for a while, and so I can relate to that idea that so many people just get numb to the experience, that they just think they can, you know, they can hang out during the storm. They're like, we've been through this before.
We've gone through false evacuations,
right?
Evacuations that come to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But better safe than sorry.
Definitely. It's funny, too. We all kind of have our own sort of storm stories. I don't know if you have any that you remember, Sarah, maybe tornadoes that you have hunkered down
I remember being a very little kid and there being a tornado in Atlanta, and I was at ballet class. I was probably about 3 or 4, and I remember all the little kids getting taken to the basement, and we had a very hungry caterpillar read to us. That's my biggest scary storm memory, I think.
That's
which
a
is
nice
pretty good
way to write out a storm. Yeah, I remember when I was living in Mobile, I think this was 98, we had to evacuate when George came, and I had a kind of beat up Toyota Paseo that I drove at the time, and I remember driving upstate to where my parents live and just kind of blowing all over the road, and for the first time, because I like little cars, but I was thinking, I really wish I had like one of those big, yeah, something really heavy to kind of anchor me down at this point. But
well, send us your storm stories. I mean, I guess living in Atlanta, we're most likely to experience tornadoes, hurricanes. We get pretty heavy hurricanes from time to time, not coastal levels, of course. And then the occasional freak ice storm.
We had one of those a couple years ago.
So feel free to share your most interesting storm stories with us, either on Facebook, on our Twitter at Mist in History. You can email them to us at historypodcast@discovery.com. We'd be interested. I mean, everybody likes freakish weather stories, right?
That's true. And if you want to learn a little bit more about some of the storms that we talked about today and some additional ones, we have a great article on our site called 10 Most Destructive Storms. You can look that up by visiting our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off. Starts Friday and open Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA. And I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.